network takes chances.
Welcome to Late Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. This February the 5th, 2019 edition, episode 123 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from Rakino Island in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and also from Fort Lauderdale, Florida in the United States. My name's Kevin Hester, and I'm joined by Guy McPherson, who's calling in from the road. Professor McPherson, what takes you to Florida?
I'm in Florida to assist my partner as she picks up the Airstream RV, the trailer that she had in Belize when we were living there. She went down there a couple of weeks ago, hauled it all the way to the port. They loaded it into a ship, and it's in the port right now, and we're awaiting customs to see if it can get cleared, and we can then sell the thing and get out of here. So it's just a little detour. Life is what happens when you're making other plans. This is what happened this week.
Always another surprise every day.
I'm so surprised for one thing that we're still here to talk about another day. That's the good news.
True that. We're supposed to be joined by our special guest for today's show, award-winning journalist Dar Jamail. Dar's a staff writer with Truth Out. His latest book, The End of Ice, was released last month by publisher The New Press. We've talked to Dar on the show a few times before, and we look forward to a discussion about his latest book. You can find more about Dar at his website, darjamail.net. That's darjamail.net. Unfortunately, as is often the case with these trans-global conversations, we're having trouble getting Dar online, so I think we'll just have a quick talk about an overview of the book and also Guy McPherson's new book that's coming out, and hopefully us at some stage shortly. If not, we'll ask Studio to play a segment from a Last Born in the Wilderness interview that Patrick Farnsworth did recently with Dar Jamail. But Guy, on to you and your book while we're waiting.
Sure. And if you're listening live, please call in with your questions or comments for us, and presumably a bit later for Dar as well. Our toll-free number here is 888-874-4888. And we would give you the outside of the United States number, except we're having real problems with it getting it to go. So give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. And Kevin, to answer your question, Only Love Remains, Dancing at the Edge of Extinction, is a book that was inspired by the forthcoming film by the same name by my partner, which was in turn inspired by our 2016 trip to meet with you on a tour that you created in the country that you occupy. So it's an idea that started with the three of us as we were driving around from venue to venue, and it was going to be turned into a documentary film, and that's still in process. But shortly after that, of course, we were living in Belize, and life is a daily struggle there just to get through the day. So that has delayed the creation of the film for a bit, and the book carried on for better and for worse. And it's now ready as of about a week ago. Only Love Remains, Dancing at the Edge of Extinction. You can find the details and links to the Kindle and paper versions at the bottom of each of my recent blog posts.
Oh, that's really exciting news, both for the book and the documentary. A lot of the people around New Zealand who help make that tour possible, like I was the coordinator of it, but there was a lot of people involved in making it happen. They'll be inspired to see different sequence of that trip and how it affected people and the wonderful Q&A discussions we had afterwards, which were extraordinary in their honesty and sensitivity, because no one, you know, you can't digest this news easily. It takes a lot to metabolize it and to come out the other side.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a challenge. When you know that every goodbye might be your last goodbye, and probably it's not, at least with the people you see on a regular basis, that leads to living with urgency. It also leads to living with ambiguity. And I don't know about most people, but I'm not very good at either one of those things. Living with urgency is exhausting, and living with ambiguity is difficult, of course, and that's how we spend pretty much all of our lives. It looks like, based on messages I'm seeing, that we have Dar on the line. Dar Jamail, are you with us?
Yeah, hey there, you guys. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We can indeed. Good to hear your voice again, brother.
Thanks, you too.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Dar. We've each of us, Kevin and I, met Dar in person and also chatted with him on the air. Dar, welcome to Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks again.
I'd like to start with a question from the end of ice. My question is inspired by the subtitle. Yes, I didn't even get past the cover before I had a question. The subtitle is Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Dar, what do you mean by, quote, finding meaning in the path of climate disruption?
Well, that subtitle was a long time coming, and in fact, it didn't really kind of come into its own until right before I sent in the absolute final last draft of the manuscript. It had various other subtitles. I can't even recall what they were anymore. But it came to this because, you know, the bearing witness part, briefly, since your question's on the second half of it, the bearing witness part is that, as you guys know, we have to be honest about where we are at this point in history. We have to be honest about the dire nature of the crisis, about how far along we already are, about, you know, some of these likely events that are heading our way. We have to be very honest about that. And as a journalist who's been covering this for a long time and having cut my teeth going up against the corporate press because of the Iraq war, I'm very sensitive to that and you know, a bit, motivated, we can say, to really show the truth of what's happening compared to the really ignoring of the crisis on a certain exit of the corporate press. And so then that leads into the finding meaning part, because as I have gone through the long process of really coming to terms psychologically and spiritually about what it means to live during a time where we don't, you know, unlike the world that I grew up in, where there was essentially just, it was assumed that there was a future. It was assumed that biosystems were going to continue and the world as I knew it and grew up in was going to continue. And now we live in a world where that's not guaranteed. We live in a world where, you know, I would feel comfortable saying that Western civilization, it's only, I'm pretty amazed there hasn't been wholesale collapse already. I think that it's just a matter of a very, very short time. And then, you know, the chaos that will ensue from that, not even, and of course, this is due largely from climate impacts and drought and disruption of food systems and lack of water, et cetera. But, you know, how do we find meaning in a world now where we know that things are imminent, things like on the sixth map, knowing what from what's hard and what's baked into the system, that, you know, we're coming into an era, which I started calling, and I don't think I can claim that I made this up. I probably heard it somewhere, but it's an era of loss. Yeah, I mean, it's,
which is, you know, very easy to
accept. The book kind of forced me into, by the time I got to writing the last chapter, after all the other chapters, it's clear, like, okay, basically we are in this very, very deep now, that it really begs the issue. How do each of us find meaning now? And I did my best to bring forth to the reader what I was doing at the time, where the book had brought me, of how I was trying to find meaning, live in this age of loss. Because it really, I'll just add that it really, you know, it leaves us taking in all this science. You do so by reading my book, or reading the reports that are coming out, or reading my dispatches, or reading what other people are putting out there. It brings us to a point where, you know, and I personally have gone through it, and I know that both of you have, is going through the depression and really struggling at times with things. And I went through all that, even with this book, and then getting to a point of, I have to find, you know, but I'm still here. There's trees still here. There's still a lot of other species still here. And how do I find meaning? And so I have essentially found it by really being brought into contact with a couple of indigenous elders, and one of them I bring in along with some stories he passed along to me into the end of my, and it really essentially, if I had to boil it down, it has come down to me the fact that I have to kind of abandon a lot of the ontology that I was raised in, which is Western colonial culture's idea that we all have these rights and the privileges that come along with that, and really let that go and move into a more indigenous way of looking at the world, which is, no, actually, if we're adults in this world today, we have obligations to future generations, not just of humans, and to the earth. And so, regardless, I am here to try to be of service in any way that I can to the future generations.
I think that we have I think we have a moral obligation to tell the truth to the youth and not be the last generation of elders lying to the last generation of youth. On that subject, I think I'd like to bring our listeners' attention to a new series of articles that you're writing in conjunction with Barbara Truth Out, titled, As the Climate Collapses, We Ask, How Shall We Live? I think that's where you're going to be exploring this aspect of the unraveling. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. And we published the first piece of this series, which is really, every piece is an experimentation, as is the whole series, because we're really diving into this finding meaning part of this time of history. And so the first article we ran yesterday was by people when I'm now giving talks about my book of, you know, shall I have children? Or if we have children, how do we talk to them about it? I've stopped saying or believing for sure humans are going to exit the stage, or even if that, you know, and I'm very careful about how I talk about this, because by the end of the last chapter, it's clear. What's baked into the system and everything that's already happening, and certainly what is to come, it looks intensely dire. But I have really decided that it doesn't. I don't want to be the person to make the decision or think that I have the authority to say absolutely we're going to be gone by X time. And I think that might be, something that we disagree on. But I just need to be clear for me that I can't do that personally. And another motivation of mine for that is that in indigenous, the one line you don't ever cross if you're going to have to pick one. Here outside of Santa Cruz, of young college kids, and this. And everything that I know about, methane that's already being released and what's already baked into the oceans and what all this means, I'm not going to be the person to tell that for sure, because we just don't know for sure. Nobody does, since we've never been here, I don't think. And I'm certainly, because of where I'm coming from now as a result of writing this book, not going to be the person to say that to younger generations.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary tough call, and it's an incredible place for us all to be stuck in, where we're trying to make sense of it. And what do we say and what don't we say? It's just incredible that never in the history of our species before have we been in a situation where we have to have this kind of conversation.
Well, and the one thing I think that we would all agree on is that no matter how bleak things look, that we have to default into this, what Guy had just mentioned, moral obligation, that no matter what, no matter how long we think we have or where any of us stand on that, that regardless, each day that I get up, I feel that I have a moral obligation to try to be of service, to help people, to give people good information, both about the climate as well as some of the things I'm exploring about literally just how do we be during this time, because it's an absolutely unprecedented time. And then another thing that I've learned that is helping me, and I'm going to explore this, is looking at other cultures who have already been through genocides and things like this. And I think we probably have some things to learn from survivors of those things, at least, again, with this uncertain future, we don't know if this is our last act or not, but even if it is, I think we probably still have a lot to learn from these people who have already been through sort of their own cultural apocalypse, if you will.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Dar. And you make another good point about not predicting the date of our demise. I would say that's a job for scientists, not journalists, to make predictions. And yet you also indicated some surprise that I share, that civilization has made it this far, that industrial civilization is still cranking on sufficiently to allow us to have this conversation across the continents. And so that does bring simultaneously ambiguity and urgency into the situation. And how do you... These are my messages of late, is the difficulty of living with urgency and ambiguity. If everybody knew their expiration date, if everybody knew they were going to die on at a certain time on a certain date, I suspect they would live very differently than they currently are living, given the infinite growth paradigm. So how do you balance that urgent message that you're carrying so eloquently with the ambiguity of we don't know when it's all over?
This is a really, really interesting thing to tease out. And it's really a place that I've been I would say, I wouldn't say making it up as I go along. Maybe that's being flippant, but I'm still learning how to do that every day. And I think some days I do a better job of it than others. I still sometimes too, you know, as we've talked about in the past, you don't just go through the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross five stages of grief once and then that's good. And nor do you go through it linearly. I mean, I watch myself still bouncing around a lot. I do feel like I'm in acceptance the majority of the time, but still struggle with depression. And sometimes, you know, what's the point of any of this and why keep writing about it, et cetera. But I think that what you just said, really, I think that's the space that each of us ideally is kind of living in. If those of us who really understand the dire crisis that we're in and how far along we already are, and certainly what's coming, that how, you know, it when we get that on my better days, when I really get that and understand that, and that's part of my operating system as I go out with a lot of amazement, that everything's still trundling along as it is, i.e. the political system, the economic system, et cetera, but then also I go out with a deeper appreciation of what is here, like the window right now, and see these trees, and I'm nearby the Pacific Ocean, or seeing birds, and seeing things that are still here with this really, really deep, deep appreciation. And other times, like, even going out to a restaurant at a nice meal and just, wow, I can afford to do this. And wow, there's, you know, we can still go out and eat these meals. And I really, on my better days, that's how it feels, which is really an extraordinary way to live. In a way, I think it's the silver lining of this whole crisis is it's really, if you go through the five stages and then really do this dance and live in a deeper acceptance of what's happening, then it kind of forces us into this zen-like, maybe not force is the wrong word, but it really kind of brings us into this more zen-like appreciation of, you know, I have my health, I have shelter, I have food, I have clean water. There's, you know, we still have some clean air to breathe here. I mean, it's a really amazing time. And I write about it, you know, I bring up the hospice analogy in my book. And it's like when I'm sitting with a friend who it looks as though he's on the way out, every single moment is absolutely precious. And on my better days, that's the way I feel like living on the earth right now.
You know, even Kubler-Ross in her definitive book pointed out that people go back and forth between these stages, that in fact, she's been widely misinterpreted as treating these things at stair steps, as a one-way street, as it were. And so it's no particular surprise that you and everybody else who is willing to deal with environmental grief or climate grief or whatever you want to call this feeling that it encompasses far more than the loss of a single thing or a single individual. So ambiguity is part of the story. There's no question about it, at least for me. And as with you, I am inspired each day to acknowledge and appreciate the kinds of things, activities, items, relationships, whatever, that I barely even noticed before. And so in a way, this ability to acknowledge that we are close to the brink, we're at the highest temperature on the planet that has ever supported the species Homo sapiens before. And so acknowledging that in a way sets me free. It makes me appreciate every moment even more than when I was on the treadmill and pursuing the daily grind. And I think, Kevin, you might have something to add to that as well from your perspective.
I think the description of our predicament as being that the biosphere and everything on it is in hospice is the perfect analogy. And I've had some pretty positive experiences with hospice. One recently where a neighbor of mine died on the island and with my parents. And I think that if people can just wrap their head around what the reality of the situation is and then embrace every last moment, because it could be our last moment, and make as much time to get out into the natural world as possible, is probably, for me, the best way for me to deal with the grief situation where I've been fortunate enough to be able to volunteer at a native tree nursery on the island, and I'm planting and propagating native trees, knowing full well that the climate that they have adapted and evolved for is not going to be here in months or years ahead. But I think it's a way for me to keep my sanity and for me to show some respect to Gaia. Hey, relative to what we're all talking about, are you aware of the recent work that's been put out by two British scientists, Jem Bendel and Rupert Reed, about their predictions of the imminent collapse of industrial civilization as a result of runaway abrupt climate change?
I am, yeah, and I really appreciate it, and I subscribe to their logic and the thinking behind it, and I think they do a very well job of laying it out as well as articulating it in a way that is very, very helpful and accessible to a large and growing number of people. And I'm happy to see that. I haven't read absolutely everything that they have put out, but what I have seen of just the basics that it's inevitable, the collapse of Western civilization. And there's plenty of other studies in addition to what they've written to back that up. And they've been coming out for a long time. And I know that both of you have cited them as well, as have I, are getting that memo, and thanks in large part to their work.
We do have a caller, and before I introduce Gaio from Arkansas, I'd just like to make a point. Because of what we know of the aerosol masking effect or global dimming and the rate of temperature increase as even a relatively significant proportion of industrial civilization fails to continue pumping aerosols into the atmosphere, it seems to me that the rate of change is what's important, especially given the future rate of change. And it's difficult for me to imagine habitat for humans persisting after industrial civilization meets its untimely demise. That said, Gaio from Arkansas, are you with us? Do you have a question or a comment?
Hello. What a privilege.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, this is wonderful. I'll make it quick. We were talking about the timeline, and I think, Guy, you've got it to where you're surprised we're still here. I think with the way things are, that's really the point of past acceptance, past hope, is acknowledging that, you know, you're just amazed that we're here still, you know, that. I mean, that's where I'm at. And it's, of course, I'm older. I don't have little kids, and it's tough. And I don't have an editor, and I don't have, you know, book customers and all that. So it's tough. But I just think once you're at that point, then, and I owe it to you, and thank you, and all three of you for leading me on this path to where I think, you know, I'm ready to go. So, and it's just the way it is. Thanks, though.
Well, thank you, Gaio. Thank you for calling in and for that comment. Yours is an especially tough situation. You're the only one of the four on this call that have a child, and so that makes it especially difficult. I can only imagine what you're going through. Dar, did you want to follow up? Did you want to comment on that?
I would just add that one thing that he touched on, I'm assuming it was an allusion to my book and people, since the book just came out a couple of weeks ago, is that every word in the book is mine, and I didn't change anything because of an editor or to sell books. And I think anyone that reads my book is going to understand how I see the science from having gone out directly into the field with scientists from on the Great Barrier Reef, talking about how it looks like coral is going to be gone well in advance of the NOAA report from 2011 that it warned it would be gone by 2050. And have scientists in my book, one in particular speaking, around the Western United States to the imminent demise of alpine glaciers. I mean, as we're speaking today, the New York Times has a piece out talking about, you know, what's happening in the Himalaya. All these things coming out now that I have been writing about for a long time. I know that, Guy, you've written about it for a long time. And so my point is that by the time you read through these chapters of the book, it's really clear what is happening on the planet and where this is going. And, of course, most importantly, including what's happening with permafrost and methane, and that's why I went up to northern Alaska and have a whole chapter on that in the book. So all that said, where the book brought me and what I get into in the last chapter is, again, the finding meaning part. How do we live then? I mean, I think each one of us is going to have our own individual experience, and it's just like how when each of the three of us have given talks or given interviews and we're asked, well, what do we do? And I can't answer that question for anybody, and I don't think you guys try to either. I think it's a very individual, personal response to how do we live in a world now where we don't, you know, we can't count on necessarily living, you know, to an age, or, you know, we just don't know. And so how do we live? And it's you know, I think my point is I'm trying to draw an analogy where I can't anymore tell somebody what to do than I can tell them how to live their lives during this time. And so that's what I really try to bring out in the book. So I think any of us diving into this topic deeply now and really getting the gravity of our current moment in history understands it's an existential, ontological crisis, and we're all right there on the razor's edge. And I think more and more people are really grappling with how do I try to be? And if some people decide, well, that's it, I'm just going to, you know, F everything and I don't think I'm going to be here in a year, well, that's your choice to live that way. But that's not how I'm choosing to live my life today.
Right, absolutely. It comes through very clearly that you are not telling anybody how to live. I don't think any of us have enough hubris that we would do that. And that it's also clear that you recommend through your actions, through the way you live, that you recommend living with urgency. And appreciating what we have, and sort of, as you indicated at the beginning of this interview, a little surprised that we're around today to appreciate what we have. So I think getting across that message in a subtle, nuanced manner is no easy task, and I think you've done it brilliantly in the book. We have another caller, Joe from Maryland. Are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here, Guy.
Thank you. What do you got for us?
So I just want to tell you guys that I am 27, the millennial, different from the guy who just called from Arkansas. So I have a little different perspective on this whole abrupt climate change and the eventual human extinction. And I recently discovered your work, Guy, back in October when I just came back from living in Alaska for about 6 months. And I kind of went through the rabbit hole of watching your videos and coming to terms that it's going to end very soon. And it's weird because you're in this paradoxical predicament where it's, yes, I still do have plans for the future, but at the same time, we won't be having a future. And living with that and coming to terms with that was a big kind of mind alter. It just messed with your mind a little bit. But just wanted to comment on, just want to say thank you guys, Dar, Kevin, and you, Guy, for putting out the message. And I feel like it's a disservice that a lot of scientists aren't doing that. And I feel like it's just people need to hear this. And another comment, just if you guys should watch the movie First Reformed. It's a movie about a priest who struggled between hope and despair while coming to terms with abrupt climate change. And I feel like you guys would definitely enjoy that film.
Cool. Thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Have a good rest of your day.
So
thank you.
That brings up the topic of hope. And last month, I posted an essay at GuyMcPherson.com titled "Hope is a Mistake and a Lie." The outrage began immediately, including promises to kill me. This is nothing new, of course, including the failure to deliver on the promises. But what about hope, Dar, from your perspective? And before you respond, a quote from the final chapter of The End of Ice. You write, "I had hoped my work in Iraq would contribute to ending the U.S. occupation of the country. I had hoped, too, that writing climate dispatches and bludgeoning people with scientific reports about increasingly dire predictions of the future would wake them up to the planetary crisis we find ourselves in. It has been very difficult for me to surrender that hope. But I came to understand that hope blocked the greater need to grieve, so that was the reason necessitating the surrendering of it." So what do you mean? What do you mean by surrendering hope, and where does that go in terms of grief, and does this mean you've given up in the fight against climate change? Can you fill us out with a little bit more info here?
Well, great, fantastic topic, and I get asked this all the time, and I've actually grown quite averse to the word hope, and it's you know, I think going all the way through the process of coming to acceptance about where we are at this point in history with the climate, the planet, and being a Canadian who, this is a guy who worked at, I imagine a lot of the listeners are probably familiar with Jenkinson's work, was there, High Wise, which I pulled some quotes out of music, as well as some quotes from him from a talk he gave at a university in Vancouver, Canada, ways back. And he was talking about climate change. And he says, the question is not, are we going to fail? The question is how. He says, the question is, what shall be the manner of our inability to care for what was entrusted to us? You know, he's as he said, you know, we've already failed about grief and about loss and about death and about dominant Western culture's aversion and denial of death. And he goes on to say that grief for what's happening on the planet right now literally requires us to know what time we're in. Basically, that we are in this time of loss. And he goes on to say that, and I'm going to quote him now. I have the book in front of me because he says it better than I, which is why I quote him. He says, "The great enemy of grief is hope. Hope is the four-letter word for people who are unwilling to know things for what they are. Our time requires us to be hope-free, to burn through the false choice of being hopeful or hopeless. They are two sides of the same con job. Grief is required to proceed."
That's great. And I'm a big fan of Stephen Jenkinson. He's been interviewed on this radio show in the past. And what he says and writes is consistent with my plea for planetary hospice. I think we're at that point that's the step that makes sense for us as individuals with respect to relating to the living planet. We have a couple of callers, and I'd like to squeeze in at least one of them. We have E from Edgewater. E, are you still with us?
Yes, thank you for taking my call, sir.
Sure.
I have a comment to make. You know, I'm very distressed by what's going on in the planet today, and there's many shows that talk about, you know, what's going on with Donald Trump and all these leaders, and it looks like, you know, they're all out of their minds. And this, what I see is what's going on is this genocide is going on, and it's because they need to get the planet down to where it could somehow recover, and they think the only chance is by eliminating half the population, and they couldn't just come out and tell us that they just have to eliminate people. So they're doing it in this way of this insanity that's going on, and we're not seeing the truth of that. And, you know, like animals, when they see there's not enough food, they're able to adjust their births by instinct. They have less offspring if they don't see enough game out there so that their offspring could survive. They have less young. You know, wolves do that. Many, many animals do that. But that's by instinct. We make choices by freedom of choice. So if they came out, if the governments of the world came out and said, we have to stop having children for at least the next 5 years until people start dying off naturally and no new people are being born, and then that could somehow get the things back into balance. I don't think we're responsible enough as people to say that we would be willing to do that. And that's what a big problem is, and that's why they're doing it this other way, by poisoning the skies and forcing people to get vaccines and you know, doing things in this evil. We see it as evilness, but they think they're doing something to help the population of at least having half of us survive if they get rid of the other half of us. We can't survive
Thanks for that, Scott. I think you're talking about the same thing that Professor Paul Ehrlich spoke about in his 1968 book, The Population Bomb. So, you know, many, many decades ago, we knew that we were already heading to population overshoot. Thanks for your input, Scott.
And we have another caller, Scott from Missouri. Scott, are you still with us? Thanks for your patience.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I had a question for Dar. I was wondering what he thought about the use by many mainstream climate scientists of the 2100 timeline. Does he think it's a dishonest thing for them to use that?
I do. I'm glad you brought that up. And I want to admit my own fallacy sometimes of also using that in a lot of information I give, because it's easy as a journalist, you know, being inundated with all of these reports, using that timeline to kind of sometimes forget and just use these statistics because they're so easily available. And so I've actually taken it upon myself recently, meaning literally just the last couple of weeks when I've been going around talking about the book, where I'm actually starting to give timelines on things that are far, far more in advance of that. And then when I do come up against a statistic that is using that timeline, well, like temperatures or sea levels, et cetera, could rise X amount by 2100, I also point out that as nonlinear feedback loops kick in and they all are feeding off themselves, that, you know, we have, it's a stretch even for our own imaginations to look like, to imagine what things are going to look like beyond 2100. You know, I mean, if we're going to talk about future generations, we have to talk about that as well. That, you know, 2100, I mean, kind of like right now, that as intense as things are on the planet right now, you know, and that's another thing that I'm pointing out, is there's no more future tense about climate disruption, that we are in it now. And for those of us, you know, who have homes and shelter and food, and we still have some money in our pocket and can still go out and use some of these luxuries of Western civilization. You know, if you live in Paradise, California, and you just had everything you own incinerated and were lucky to get out enough with your life, you know, there's no future tense anymore about climate change for you. It's already taken over your life. If you live in the panhandle of Florida and just had your entire neighborhood just got obliterated by a giant hurricane and the floods, then, you know, you're not talking about 2100. You're not talking, oh, it's going to get a lot worse. You've already lost everything. And you can point right now the tens of millions. To timelines like 2100, that's really a bit of a privilege and a luxury, as well as being, I think, dangerously misleading.
One of the things that I was very happy to see was you mentioned that we are already in runaway abrupt climate change. And I think this is an issue that people really need to get their heads around. We're not in the linear stage anymore. We're in the non-linear stage. And to quote Albert Bartlett, one of the greatest shortcomings of the human race is its inability to understand the exponential function. People don't realize how quickly this will destabilize.
That's right. And I address that in the book, kind of in a more indirect way, where I was in Glacier National Park with Dr. Dan Fagry, USGS scientist who's there, heavily involved in studying the glaciers and a big part of the benchmark mass balance survey program that USGS has been conducting now for over half a century. And I asked him point blank at one point, I've kind of put him on the spot to get a little bit more personal with me. And I said, how do you feel about, as a scientist, which most are loath to talk about, but how do you feel watching what's happening to these glaciers, you know, because they're, you know, Glacier National Park, they're going away so rapidly. I mean, he made international news that month that I was speaking with him by saying, actually reiterating something he had said before. And he told me as well that, you know, there's not going to be any functional glaciers left in Glacier National Park by 2030. And he said probably even before that. So, you know, we're talking, you know, arguably single digit years here. And I said, so what's that like for you? And he said, it feels like a lot of time, like I have to be a battle hardened soldier, because it's really hard to watch the thing that you study disappear. And then as far as the feedback loops, I said, you know, I asked him what up at night, and to paraphrase his response, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he said something to the effect of exactly what you just pointed out, Kevin, that it's the nonlinear feedback loops, and then not just them on their own, but then all of them together and feeding off of one another. And that, and, you know, he worries about when that's going to really come up to speed across the entire planet, at which point, of course, it's clear that, you know, things are more than out of control. And he said that thought of all those feedback loops kicking in and feeding off each other, that was what kept him up at night.
Dar, I'd like to talk at least a little bit about the science of the end of ice. And Sasha, I know we have you on hold there in California. Please bear with us for a few more minutes. Specifically, Dar, can you summarize your book's conclusions regarding the near-term loss of ice in the Arctic Ocean, what some people call the planetary air conditioner?
Right. Well, I did go up and spend time in Alaska, and I looked at that, and I don't believe I put a hard date on that in the book about when that's expected to be gone, because when I'd written about it in the past, I thought for sure it was going to be gone somewhere around the time of the Navy study that predicted 2016 plus or minus a few years, which is actually looking relatively accurate. But I don't recall if in the book if I made a prediction. But as of right now, just looking not at predictions or projections or anything like this, but if you just look at the hard data of the ice loss and look at it at a graph right now, it's really hard to see that there's going to be any summer Arctic sea ice left by 2023. So a little bit less. So what's that? So it's about three and a half years or so from now. That seems to be right now to what looks like, and assuming current things are going quasi-linearly, which is, I think, a wrong assumption, but it just, if we were going to say best case scenario, it does look like probably 2023 is going to be the latest that we would still have summer sea ice up in the Arctic.
And what does that mean? Where does that lead to from a scientific perspective or from a continuing assault on the environment perspective?
Well, that means that global climate patterns and systems and all the associated weather patterns and systems with them go haywire, that everything becomes utterly destabilized and chaotic, and weather patterns change, rain patterns change, ability to grow food becomes extremely challenging, and I think business as usual is kaput at that point, and that's when it's really going to come into you know, how resilient are local systems and where are we situated on the planet when that happens. The one thing for sure is that this is definitely a game changer once that summer Arctic sea ice goes away. And that's another reason why I went up to Alaska and dedicated a whole chapter to talking about permafrost and methane, because we all know that the subsea methane, once that sea ice is gone, there's really nothing stopping. And we already know the Arctic Ocean is warming dramatically. And I cite one part of the book, which I'll throw in here. It's not directly related to the sea ice question, but at least indirectly, where Dr. Ira Leifer in the book, one of the scientists who's a methane expert and has been using NASA satellites to track methane in the Arctic for a long time. And he actually has a peer-reviewed study that he had already published back in 2012, where they studied methane releases in the Barents Sea, and they used NASA satellites to do this. And the normal background rate for the number of methane plumes, of natural methane plumes coming up from that part of the Arctic Ocean seabed, was around 3,000 methane plumes over 1,000 square kilometer area. And they had found a 1,000 square kilometer area where they had already tracked methane in Arctic sea ice. And this was, that study was published, if I remember correctly, in 2012. So you can imagine what, then how does that translate and what does that mean when there is no summer Arctic sea ice reflecting the brunt of the solar radiation and the warmth back in the space.
Even the president of Finland was prepared to say in a public forum that if we lose the Arctic sea ice, we lose the world.
And there's certainly, I mean, given what I just shared and other things that I include in that chapter of what does it mean when the permafrost continues to thaw and hit these different thresholds and that much more CO2's at it, and then the sea ice is gone and all of that methane starts to come up. I mean, he certainly has ground to stand on saying that. What exactly that looks like and how that plays out, who knows? But certainly the world as we know it and anything like business as usual is going to be a thing of the past when that happens. I think that's safe to say.
Absolutely. Sasha, would you like to ask your question of Dar?
Well, thank you very much. I'm very grateful and glad to hear all of you together on this show today. And I'm grateful that your show is being updated at least once a month, maybe three or four times a month. With the timestamp on the front end. Anyway, I don't want to make this much about me, but just to give a little background story, I've been a listener of Pacifica since 1987, a Green Party volunteer activist since about 1989, and I kind of really, you know, woke up. I've been feeling, you know, long periods of grief since at least that far back, but even before then, I was a participant in the commune of Rajneesh in north central Oregon, and before that, I visited the ashram in Pune, India, for a few months prior to him coming to the United States, and I really believed at that young age, when I was only about 22 years old, that we had a chance to turn things around on this planet. There was still time, and you know, losing that whole experiment, seeing it basically crushed by the Reagan Meese administration, pretty much dashed all hopes from that moment forward. And seeing the Green Party as like maybe a last ditch effort, maybe we can turn things around on a global scale, you know, from our own local perspectives here in Southern California, and you know, and connected with everyone else, I felt there was a lot of hope. But you know, now I'm been listening. You know, I've been hearing you, Dar, for the last at least dozen years or so on KPFK, and then hearing your recent interviews in several shows. And I'm just, you know, I'm definitely going to get your book and tell people about it. And I tell people every chance I get about PRN and Pacifica, really since the beginning, since 1987, I've been telling people every day practically that I talk to anybody. Hey, do you know about KPFK? Now I'm saying also, do you know about PRN? And I just,
cool,
I don't
Sasha,
know. Maybe,
thanks
I mean,
for that. We're just coming to the, I'm going to have to thank you and let you go. And we've got one more input from Guy, please.
Yeah, thank you, Sasha. Thanks to Dar. I would like to close this portion before we say goodbye to Dar with the final words of Dar's book. Again, the title of the book just out last month is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And the final lines are, when I orient myself around the question, what are my obligations? The deeper question immediately arises. From this moment on, knowing what is happening to the planet, to what do I devote my life? And I think that's a question not only for Dar, and a great question to end the book with, but a question for all of us, for Kevin, for you, for me, for Dar, for anybody listening. If you know your time is short, and bearing in mind that birth is a sexually transmitted disease that is proven lethal in every case, and that life is always short, to what do I devote my life? I think that's a wonderful question. Thank you, Dar. And Kevin, why don't you take us on home?
One last thing I'd like to mention is that Dar will be coming to New Zealand in July, and we'll be touring around the country a little bit, doing public meetings, talking about where Dar will do readings from the book, and we'll have a few Q&As. I'd really look forward to seeing you again, Dar, and you never know, we might even get a chance to dive the Poor Knights Marine Reserve again and see what's happened in the 2 years since we were last there. I'll hand over to you, Guy.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Dar, for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks to our listeners and callers today. You can catch NBL on PRN the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The next episode, only 28 days from today, will broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 5th of March. If you missed the live broadcast, you can find shows in the archives at prn.fm, on Podbean, or at Stitcher, and feel free to rate us on iTunes. Also, continue to follow my blog, Nature Bats Last, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, interviews, and speaking tours. You can keep current with Kevin's work at kevinhester.live. Again, thanks to today's guest, Dar Jamail, to our listeners, to those who called in, and to Afra Zen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Nature Bats Last. Get you.